Okay, next we have a panel discussion. This is going to be led by Garrett Bowles, who is the chair of the Discographic Committee on the Associated Audio Archives Committee. And he's going to do the introductions for the panel, the other panel members. They'll be speaking about the new publication Rules for Archival Cataloging of Sound Recordings.
Yes, I'd like to introduce my fellow committee members. The ones that are here today are, take a seat.
Yes, sir.
Vincent Pallotti from Rutgers University, Brenda Nelson Strauss from the Chicago Orchestra, and David Summerfield from the Library of Congress. In addition, the committee has consisted of C. Gerald Parker from Montreal University and Charles Simpson from SUNY Binghamton. What I'm going to talk about today is the publication just about 8 months ago, something like that, about the time of our last meeting of the Ars Cataloging Rules, the second edition. And these rules came about initially through the AAA, because the first time that the AAA, well, the first meeting that the AAA started, you can put up the first edition. When the AAA first started, the whole idea was to try to catalog the collections of the institutions who were involved in the AAA. And the people who were involved in that, the initial AAA, were myself. I was at Stanford University then. Jim Creighton at University of Toronto. That made us an international group. Jerry Gibson from the Library of Congress. David Hall from New York Public Library, Don Seibert from Syracuse University, and Richard Warren from Yale University. We were initially funded by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, and that's the grant number there. And the title of the planning study was a union catalog of commercially issued pre-LP classical music and spoken word sound recordings, take a breath, a planning study. We began work under the NEH funding on October 1st, 1976, and we initially completed our work in 1978. This was a very interesting time in American libraries, because this was the time when the Anglo-American cataloging rules were being developed and were just being published at that point, and the MARC music format was also under development and was just about to be published at this point. The AAA had seven working meetings, during that time we mostly concentrated on the cataloging rules, because that was the thing that we felt was so important to do, because we needed to have some way of bringing together a unified way of cataloging recordings so that all the institutions would be able to do it. And the other problem was that nobody at that point had really done a very careful examination of what were the needs for an archival cataloging of the 78 RPM recordings and cylinders, which were really our initial examination. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of appropriate that we're following a session about cylinder recordings, because this is now the way the intent was that this would be the way that one could catalog the cylinder collections that you had, as well as the 78 RPM collections. And as I said, the rules were based under development and unpublished ACR2 and MARC music format. You can actually leave that for a moment. I'd like to read from the introduction to the cataloging rules, because it really gives a pretty good development of what the principles were that we were attempting to follow in developing these cataloging rules, and an idea about what the content of those rules were in our our points of view in attempting to develop those cataloging rules. Inasmuch as there had never before been a careful, in-depth examination into all of the elements and procedures involved in the archival cataloging of sound recordings, the great majority of the time spent during the meetings of the participants was concentrated on the development of a cataloging standard. The participants included the private collectors. These people here were private collectors, record producers, librarians, sound archivists, and catalogers. So we had a very broad perspective on recorded sound to look at. Half of the participants, in addition, were actively involved in either the development of the MARC music format or in the development of AACR2. Virtually every aspect of the documentation of historical sound recordings was reviewed, and that's why it took 7 working meetings. It was realized, however, that the final rules for the archival cataloging of sound recordings had to conform as closely as possible to the revised edition of the Anglo-American cataloging rules in order to be acceptable to the participating institutions and to sound libraries and the library community in general. In addition, they had to be compatible with existing library automation formats and systems. Consequently, the rules were circulated to a wide variety of readers in both North America and Europe, and their comments carefully considered. In addition, the processing department of the Library of Congress reviewed the rules for descriptive cataloging and agreed to endorse them. The goal of archival cataloging of sound recordings is to provide a description sufficient to distinguish one sound recording from all others. The uniqueness of any sound event can only be fully determined through audition, through listening. Perhaps the most important early decision, which was continually reviewed and repeatedly endorsed, was that individual recordings should not be auditioned during cataloging because of the length of time it would take to do that. A union cataloging project, and part of the problem, of course, is that the longer it takes to catalog a recording, the more expensive it is to catalog it. So, and we were under a considerable constraint as far as money was concerned. A union cataloging project, including collections scattered throughout the country, also makes comparison auditioning very difficult. Therefore, every effort is to be made to describe the physical appearance of the recordings in sufficient detail to distinguish variant recordings. By recording such details as the radius of the playing area, it was hoped to be able to distinguish variant takes of a recording of a 78. Although important decisions determined that the basis of the cataloging record would be the individual intellectual unit existing as sound embodied on a recording, the intellectual unit occurs on a continuum between a performance closely controlled by a pre-existing script, that is, a musical score or a work of literature, and a performance primarily shaped in the mind of the performer or performers, that is, improvisation. In classical music, the performance might contain more of the score and fewer of the participants' ideas, performers' ideas. In spoken drama, the performance might be balanced since such matters as pitch, speed, and emphasis are not usually specified in a script. In popular music, the performer's ideas might greatly outweigh the notes of the original score, and in jazz, the performance might be an improvisation based only on a tune or chord or whatever. Thus, the intellectual unit is a blend of the material performed and the performer's ideas in varying proportions. Therefore, each individual recording event of the intellectual item is to be distinguished from every other physical embodiment of that same sound event. Because the AAA was at this time most interested in cataloging 78 RPM and cylinder recordings, the recording event most often conformed with the physical recording itself. Archival collections were not available for browsing. Therefore, it was determined that all access points should be provided and tied to that intellectual unit. It means there should be a whole variety of ways of being able to look at a catalog and being able to find the recording that you want. Ascertaining publication date of early sound recordings is very difficult because a date rarely appears on the recording or its associated materials, and in the majority of instances, the record sleeves or containers which may have been issued with the recording and may have contained a date have been lost or destroyed. identification of the style of the records of the recordings label was to be entered into the database as a means of providing an indication of the issue date of a recording. A catalog, similar to a postage stamp catalog, was envisioned, containing all the label styles, each assigned an identification number. Initially, the catalog would include pictures with brief descriptions of labels, a procedure in fact used during the creation of the later AAA Wrigler Deutsch Index. Later research would, it was hoped, establish a precise chronological period for each label type. The rules for access points also were thoroughly reviewed. Traditional access points, those available through the MARC formats for music and those specially devised, were examined and ranked in order of importance. The most important were determined to be the label name issue number indicator and the recording agent name and matrix indicator. Access points linked respectively to the public issue and the recording event, or the recorded event. Other access points, such as composer title, were also important, but the label name issue number and the recording agent matrix number indicators are unique to sound recordings and to the recorded events embodied on those recordings, and therefore they provided the most direct access to commercially issued sound recordings. The traditional access points pertaining to persons, corporate bodies, subjects, and titles as they may relate to a sound recording are also included. An important addition is the inclusion of a relator statement to entries for persons. Relators are often used in traditional cataloging for editors or translators. The inclusion of the relator for performer and other functions was deemed important for clarifying the arrangement of a catalog. For example, the problem of separating works produced by a person as a performer from those produced by the same person as a composer would be eliminated. In reviewing the access points provided by the MARC music format, a number of additions and changes to the archival cataloging of sound recordings, as well as specific fields for matrix and issue designators were proposed and sent to the Music Library Association's Automation Committee, which had responsibility at that time for coordinating changes in the format. The committee approved the recommendations made by the AAA planning study and forwarded them together with their recommendations to the MARBI committee, which was a national committee responsible for the cataloging rules, which made the final decisions on changes in the MARC formats. You can put up the next slide. The revisions in 1988, published the first cataloging rules really just as off-prints of the original typescript of our draft. And that was fine for a few years, but by 1988, it was felt that it was necessary to do something more to fix them up. And the original had been lost, and it was difficult to get copies of the rules. So the Discographic Access Committee was asked to take on the task of revising the rules, and that committee consisted of the people that I mentioned to you earlier. Instead of being funded by NEH, we were funded by ARSC, mostly actually by ourselves, and we began work on the rules in 1988 on revising the rules. The basic principles of our revision were to retain the basic structure of the cataloging rules, to concentrate on clarifying and correcting the text of the rules, to continue to keep a close relationship to AACR2 and the MARC music format, and to augment the rules with a glossary and a bibliography. And the glossary was actually extracted from a glossary prepared by Don McCormick for the AAA and refined for specifically the uses of this these cataloging rules. So what's in those cataloging rules? What I'd like to do now is to go through and show you the table of contents, in essence, of the cataloging rules, and kind of point out a few of the important parts of it. And after I've done that, then I'd like to turn this over to Brenda to talk about her experiences in cataloging archives. Well, I got it out of order, didn't I? No? Okay. I looked at you first. And then Vince to talk about the experience at Rutgers. The first, in essence, the cataloging rules are divided into two parts. And you have to remember that that cataloging rules are really a guide towards, and the intent of this was a guide to developing a catalog. So the first part of it was description. And we wanted to talk about the title and the statement of responsibility, that is the title of the pieces that would be performed and the information about who might be performers, who also might be composers, translators, whatever information there might be on the recording. The next area that we dealt with was an issue area, which is statement of responsibility of who's the editor, if there is an editor, if something that's different. The next area that we dealt with publication distribution, and these are, you know, where is this thing published? We felt that it was important to actually record whenever it was possible the name of the place where something was recorded, as well as the place where it was published, and the date in which it was done, if at all possible. This was to gather the information that was actually on the recording itself. And so if there were things that were not included on the recording, pieces of information not on the recording, then those fields would be left blank, or in traditional cataloging used no date or no publication or something like that. Those up to this point, this is pretty traditional cataloging stuff, and very much conformed to AACR2. Physical description expanded upon what was already there, and because we were very interested in cylinders and LPs, the first two, 6C and 6D, we actually expanded the information that was necessary there. Could you put up the... So, for instance, for cylinders, specified the type of the recording, whether it's a wax recording or a molded recording or whatever. The generic playing speed, as best we could, the groove characteristics that would be pertinent to that cylinder as best we could determine, and the dimensions of the cylinder, that is its length, its diameter, and so forth. And those basic elements are the elements that we applied to virtually all sound media. So for discs as well, the generic, the type of the recording, what kind of a recording is it, the generic playing speed of that recording. Not all 78s are 78. So as best could be determined, that speed would be listed that pertain to it. The groove characteristics, because that varies a lot. Number of sound channels, but of course for 78s, that's generally one. But this was also expandable to LPs, and so it could go up to four, as you know. And then also the dimensions of discs. And very similar sort of information about tapes, including whether it's a cassette or a cartridge, and or a reel, and what those sizes are. So that's the information that we tried to gather in great detail for all of these recordings. The next one, next page. In addition, for the description of the recordings, we wanted to include a note area. That is an area where the cataloger supplies information about the recording that you may have gotten from other places, or in more detail than was gotten from the recording, than you would get from the recording. And the most important element here really are the publication characteristics. And we developed actually a fairly elaborate system that would identify the label name, issue number, any other kinds of indicators, you know, such as matrix numbers, performance manifestations, the issue identification, whatever library might have held that, because we realized that in archival recordings, and when you identify a recording as carefully as this would be, that there would be, you know, a single, often in many cases, a very few archives that would hold a specific thing. And this was also intended as a union catalog, that is, where could you find things? And so the library sigla was included, the identification. The other kinds of information here are pretty much standard descriptive cataloging information. You know, you would tell where you would get the source of the title if it didn't come from the standard source. You would talk about recording places and dates, and a lot of that would be information that would be supplied because you don't know it. If possible, durations and so forth, all of this information. We also included some basic information about non-processed sound recordings, that is instantaneous recordings, which basically follow these same general rules. In addition, for access, that is, how do you get into this information? We started off with collaborators, that is, those people who are actually involved in the creation of this recorded event. And we talked about composers, because most of us were kind of very much focused on classical music. But also in performers, were very important creators. And even went on to talk about editors of texts, arrangers, translators, performers, whatever, you know, you might have, other kinds of collaborators. We wanted to make sure that there was access provided to titles of compositions or whatever might have been listed on the recording, as well as if it's an excerpt from something, what was that original thing? What was the big thing? We felt it was important that there be access provided to the instrumentation of the recording, so that people would know what, in fact, was on that recording. We felt it was important to use some sort of a subject access, and since we were all working in libraries that use Library of Congress subject headings, that's really the basic structure of our subject access. And, you know, almost any kind of subject access one could have used here. And then we also went on to make sure that there was access provided to the publication and recording sessions, whenever that was possible, including the label name issue designator. So there would be, in essence, a file. You could look up RCA, whatever, and find that. Or the recording agent and the matrix identifier, so that you could look up, you know, if you had just the matrix number, you could look up that and find it in the file as well. Issue dates whenever possible, recording dates, so that, you know, if you wanted to find out how a particular performer changed over time, you could list out all of his performer dates and sort your file that way. Places of recordings, because the ambience of a room changes a recording. And whatever that event was, and then traditional series designators for access. And the last page. We also thought it was important to provide some sort of access to the physical characteristics of a recording. And since we really focused mostly on 78s and cylinders, we're talking about groove width and so forth. And this was a much more minor means of getting access to recordings, although something that was felt important enough to include as information in through the music, the MARC music format, so that at least in a computer, one could sort out the information and rearrange your files in that way. And then also we were very interested in the contents of accompanying material. Who were the authors of program notes, if there were program notes, and whatever the languages were, and so forth. And then we also dealt with collections. Now, since most of the recordings we were dealing with were 78s and cylinders, where a single side or cylinder itself is a single recording, you didn't really very often have to deal with collections. And so our real focus was, for the most part, on the individual side of a recording of a 78. And then the last two elements that are listed here from the table of contents, of course, are a glossary, which, as I say, contains a list of terms that are relevant to cataloging, but also of sound recordings. And then finally, a bibliography, which lists as many possible cataloging rules as we could find. And not all of these that did refer to sound recordings, not all of these were, in fact, I would say that not all of them were looked at. Some of them are in foreign languages that none of us could deal with. But one way or another, we did look at them enough to determine what the differences might be in the way we dealt with recordings. So what I'd like to do now is to turn it over to Brenda, and then to Vinny, and who will then at the end entertain questions from all of you. Thank you very much.
See, am I live?
Oh.
Yes. Well, I guess what I'll do is just relate briefly my cataloging experiences using the cataloging rolls. From 1985 to 1989, I worked at the Archives of Traditional Music at Indiana University. And during that time, we had a grant for cataloging our field collections. And I think that if we were probably the first institution to try to catalog non-commercial field recordings in a traditional manner. That means according to AACR2 and MARC formats, and trying to apply some cataloging rules to these collections. And I should mention that we were cataloging them on OCLC. So we really had to start from scratch. We didn't have any models to follow. We started with a very large collection of instantaneous cylinders. I think a couple thousand field recordings that had been done around the world, large collections from Russia, from China, particularly from Africa, and also quite a few collections from the Pacific Islands. These presented tremendous challenges. And I must say that the only guidelines we had at all to follow were really the first edition of the ARS cataloging rules, because nowhere else could you really come up with any method of describing these collections. And one thing that I might mention is that we had there were two forms of documentation that we had to follow, and this was really essential in beginning our cataloging project. We had whatever initial documentation, field notes or whatever, were provided by the collector of the recorded sounds. We usually referred to these as our documentation sheets, and with any luck at all, these sheets at least described the locations of the recordings, the dates, a lot of times the performers, or at least the native names of the performers, or the general culture group of the performers, and sometimes we at least had some genre descriptions. So we had that documentation to go by. Now, I should mention, too, that we did not even attempt to catalog these until they had all been recorded onto preservation copies. And as I think somebody pointed out before this session, you can't catalog something if you haven't heard it. Well, I guess I can take exception to that because I didn't really physically hear any of these recordings myself, but the engineers and the graduate students that had done the preservation copies had kept very detailed engineering logs. And so they at least were able to try to determine the playing speeds. And since these were instantaneous cylinders, the playing speeds were all over the map, you know, anywhere from probably 60-something RPMs to, or let's see, RPM wouldn't be the right term. Well, yeah, that would be revolutions per, yeah, 60 to, you know, 240. I mean, there was a really wide range. But fortunately, even by the turn of the century, for field recordings, you know, people were recommending that pitch pipes were used. So oftentimes there was at least that to go by. And I must say that our graduate students who helped with the re-recording project did as good a job as anybody could have done in trying to determine correct playing speeds for these items. So we worked off both the documentation sheets and the engineering logs to try to determine the playback speeds, the durations of the recordings, and they would log. They would try to also make a item-by-item description in the best manner. I mean, it could have just been song, or sometimes there might have been announcement before the song, and any announcements were transcribed. So we did have all of that information compiled before we even tried to attempt cataloging the collections. So that part, the descriptive part of the notes, were pretty easy. I mean, we either had the information or we didn't. But describing the physical format of the item presented the most challenges. And that's where we really turned to the artist cataloging roles. Then, after we completed the cylinder collection, we went to our collection of wire recordings. And I really had some difficulties here because I couldn't really find any descriptions of a wire recording. I mean, we had two different size spools in our collection. I think I'd asked around about the wire itself. I mean, what is the size of that wire? How do you describe it? What is the actual speed of a wire recording? And I think what we did was a mathematical equation. I mean, a lot of those you know, wire recordings say how many feet are on the recording, and then we'd play it back and get the total duration and then try to figure out what the actual speed was. So it presented a lot of difficulties, and I hope that we've been able to incorporate some of those into the cataloging rules to help other people. I mean, certainly not everything is in there, and certainly we could go a long way toward more description. But I guess you, as those of you who are collectors, you might really seriously think about that in terms of documenting your collection, because you know more about these things than other people. And if you can document some of these more obscure items in such a way that they can later be described, you know, if your collections are deposited, or to help other people who have similar items in their collections within institutions, I think that would really be a great service. I mean, another thing that's vastly confusing are tape configurations. You know, normally the box documentation is not at all good, and you have to play it back, and if you've got channels going every which way, it can present a lot of challenges and take up a great deal of time. So those are the primary issues that we encountered when we were trying to catalog these collections. But above all, I mean, the greatest challenge was just the lack of documentation on the material that came to us, and it just took an enormous amount of time playing each item back to construct an engineering log to go along with the item so that we could actually catalog it. I guess that's basically what I have to say.
I guess I'm next. Pull my chair up. Can I be heard here? I jotted down a few notes, but I have nothing really formal. So if I sound less coherent than I normally do, that's probably why. Well, let's see if I can do this without jumping all over the world here. 1978, what a year. That was the year that the Institute of Jazz Studies also decided that they were going to start cataloging their collections on a national database, something that really nobody else had done or was doing. And so my predecessor, Marie Griffin, who some of you know, and who's, by the way, doing fine in Vermont. She's retired now. She needed to come up with something to get a grant from NEH. So she threw a lot of things into this grant as to what she was going to use to accomplish this. One of the things was the cataloging rules, the RS cataloging rules, along with AACR, I guess at that time, the first edition, and the MARC music format. So those rules, the RS cataloging rules, sort of got incorporated into that grant simply because she needed to have models to go by to do this cataloging. Unfortunately, I don't have anything to show you in terms of what our cataloging looked like, the sheets that we turned out, but it was fairly detailed work. In fact, so detailed, in fact, that we had to abandon the project because we weren't getting a hell of a lot of things cataloged. But what we did get cataloged looked pretty good, say so myself. And one of the nice, a couple of the things that we did incorporate from the RS cataloging rules was the idea of the relators, because normally in the main entry you'd throw the composer in there, but with jazz that sort of sounded silly to put the composer in when the performance's importance was only because of what the performer was doing to it. So we stuck the performer into the main entry and put the relator that was the performer and not the composer. But that worked for us. Another thing that we also thought was very good was the idea of the label and the actual item description, where you would give the color of the label and you'd measure the groove radius and all that. We found that helpful because I sort of agree with the concept that you should listen to what you're going to catalog, because we did. But not in all cases. That's probably one of the reasons why we didn't get as much catalog as we probably could have. We did do a lot of listening. And when we measured the grooves of something, let's say we didn't listen to, and we saw that we had two items with two different groove measurements, then we listened to hear if indeed they were different items or if somebody just wasn't measuring correctly for some reason. And in a lot of cases, we did find out that we had alternate takes that we didn't know that we had. But also we would listen for things like, the discography would say, Joe Blow was playing, flugelhorn or something. We wanted to make sure that he indeed was playing a flugelhorn, not a cornet or a trumpet. So we did a lot of listening for that reason. What else? Okay. Pardon me here. We have cylinders in our collection, a pretty decent number, not a lot. And we do have a couple of wire recordings, but we never really got to those. So, but I guarantee you, if we did, we would have used the RS cataloging rules to to catalog them. And let's see, is there anything else to say here? Pretty much that's about it. We found them helpful for what we were doing, along with the other things, AACR, first edition and later second edition and the MARC music format. So it was sort of like a hodgepodge of things. We were sort of grabbing at whatever we could get to do what we had to do. So that's pretty much all I really have to say about that.
Okay. At this point, we'll accept questions from the floor. I would like to make one statement, though, that I think that these cataloging rules are more valuable than just something for an institution to use, because it seems to me that they provide a pattern that a private collector could use as well in trying to sort of put together their own catalog of their own collection or a discography, because it does include a fair amount of information, or does ask for a fair amount of information. But that doesn't mean you have to use them exactly the way they're written here. But it's as a pattern. And generally, I think, as you just heard, when one does start to catalog these sorts of materials, what one wants is a pattern to work with. And then it's what's important for your institution and what is important for the kind of material that you're working with in developing the kind of catalog that you really want. So are there any questions?
Yes, Jerry?
Put performer under
a
composer field, what did you put in the performer field?
The other performers. Because generally you had other
You mean there was a principal performance?
Yeah, you had the 100 field, which was where you stuck the main entry in, and then in the end you had the 700 fields where you stick the other performers in, and that's where you stuck the composer and lyricists, using the the relators to say which one was a composer, which one was a lyricist.
I think the confusion there comes from in library cataloging, you have a main entry that doesn't have to be the composer.
Right.
The main entry could be somebody with other responsibilities. So there isn't a composer field per se necessarily that's left vacant.
Right, but traditionally, that's where you stuck the composer in the main entry. Yes.
We were trying not to use that term, but.
Any other questions? Steve Smolian, yes.
I feel a
speech coming on.
Got a little list.
Speak up, Steve.
I'm concerned that the release of performances from a variety of recording circumstances, some more prone than others to editing and made over a performer's musically active lifetime, 50 years is not an unusual spread, make reconsideration of the entire sound cataloging process essential. Your rules, if I read them correctly, give priority to publication data over that of recording data. Is that correct?
No.
No.
Well, I
publication, I mean, recording data is as important as publication data, but we don't ask that you include recording data if it's not available, you know, easily available on the recording. We would hope that, you know, for a commercial recording that over time that information would be gathered and put into it, into the catalog record.
Okay, well, I think that the time has come that we now have access to recording data much more readily than when you first put these rules together. And, or dates close to them, which can be quite readily established. Regardless of how easy or difficult it may be, there is really a matrix of four units which go to identify each recording, and they really form a nucleus to which all the publications, from which all the publications then flow. And that's the recording date, the first company which actually owns the fruits of that recording session, so that that information stays with the record even if someone else buys the recording company out. Plus the recording companies, the original recording companies identifying data which includes the matrix number but which may not be present if it's an LP or a tape derived recording. The performers and the selection title which make up the atoms of this molecule, which is the recording event, and I believe out of which all further cataloging must be built. But you really need the recording date or something very close to it to make this function. And that's really, I think, that where the weakness is in the system, the way it's presently set up. It's a four-way relationship in the technical sense. They really have to move all four through the entire searching process. The present rules, which because of the lack of ability to get the recording date on a nearly complete basis, are then based on publication, are really only useful to identify an edition of a specific performance, which imposes artificial limits on the ways the catalog can be explored. It is inevitable, I believe, that the entire system will have to be refocused onto this four-element recording event, which includes the recording date. Rather than keep doing things this other way forever, it's time for the rules to acknowledge that the foregoing realities were put together, and if not by this committee, then by another committee working with it, perhaps if discographers and catalogers retrained to how to determine recording dates, what the various strategies are for closing in on them, and so forth and so on. This data can be entered into searchable fields, and as I recall, at least at one point, many of the marked fields were not searchable.
That was only an implementation.
I'm sorry?
That's not necessarily true. All marked fields are searchable. It's simply the implementation that determines whether or not they are or not.
So basically the programming that underlies it.
Right.
If the sorting report functions were rewritten and the data in the present system serve as a mask laid over this, I believe it would make a far better search mechanism. And that's basically my feeling of weakness in the system as it presently exists. It may mean that certain fields have to be broken down further. I don't know quite how much capacity you have to divide them up. But I'm not looking for a complete matrix number printout or anything like that from this. What
Why not?
I'm really concerned about is that specific performances and the multi-reissues on many, many different labels, some of them unrelated to the original recording company, will not be identified unless they go back to the recording session.
I'd like to say that in point of fact, we do expect that the recorded event itself is the element that we're focusing on. And while it may be true that we don't necessarily know exactly where the recording was made and exactly when the date of it was made, what we do try to do is to gather enough information that we can identify that these are the same different that these variant recordings that we have in front of us are pretty much the same recorded event. And sometimes that's done by just listing the matrix number, and we may not necessarily know that this matrix number was recorded at X date, but at least we know that we have that matrix indicator, and that's a very good indicator of when it happened. It's the most unique item on a commercial recording.
Of a record of a 78 or
and that's what we're talking about here.
50 years of LPs. Yeah. So there are people who discuss archival recordings and have no idea that there was ever anything of any interest before tape. But the recent Margaret Long reissue, for example, on CD from the French, which is otherwise a wonderful set, gives recording dates, but it gives absolutely no matrix information. Absolutely not.
And that's true, too, that there are a lot of recordings that have no matrix number.
Mm-hmm. So that you really need some method to tie all this up. When you do have a fragment of the information, at least something will relate them back to the original recording.
I guess the other thing is,
systematically, Steve. I realize this is expensive, but I also realize from having done catalogs over many times in my life of my own collection, I think that holds true for a lot of other catalogers here, that if you don't get that information, dig it out now, that you regret not having it in there later.
Well, I agree with that. And I want to point out, though, that, and I interpret your remarks really in this light, that what we really need is the cooperation of discographers and private collectors along with the cataloging establishment. Because, as catalogers, we work within an environment that is constrained by economics. And the administrators really want cataloging done as quickly and efficiently as possible. And if collectors and discographers can bring in additional information, then that helps the cataloging process, and it means that that everyone benefits in the long run. So it's important.
I think there's a lot more than that with it. But the way of communicating with the organizations that are going to make use of this information is what we really, I think, then might look at next as a some kind of setting up a cooperative or communicative path.
Yeah, Mark Tollison.
So NYPL, you know, there's a huge scale. You have a bazillion items. There's no chance that you'll ever be able to search them. So as what has been said, we grab what's on an item and we put it in a catalog. We rely on this discographical works that we also buy into our reading room to flesh out the rest of it as people are looking for things. The trouble is the linkage is not made between our catalog and the information we can get out of those discographies. It exists, and if we had time, we could take discographical works, sit down, go back, and flesh out our cataloging by linking the two together. It's just that we don't have the time, you know, and staff to do it, unfortunately. So we connect those things every time someone comes in with a question, basically, over and over again. The link is not permanent between that information and our catalog. And it would be great if we got a way to do that.
You had a question, Sam, or?
I think that Steve's comments, it gets down to the question of a recording event. I'm sure Brendan ran across that very immediately. It's ironic that the first application of these rules were for field recording collections, because that's always where field recording seems to be always bring up the problems in any cataloging system that are the most difficult to deal with. Because what is it you're recording? It's an event recording. But in response to Steve's, unfortunately, no one has the resources to do it. I mean, it's interesting that I learned that the National Association for Recording Arts and Sciences is setting up a master database, supposedly, of recordings. And as you know, they sort of seem to be doing it in the vacuum. No one knows exactly what they're doing. I thought maybe they were doing a discography. No, it turns out that they're trying to control the master base that are in the archives of commercial recording companies. And this seems to be the key to what might be the solution of Steve's problem is that if we were to have a big brother of discography, a big sister, that could attach a master control number to a recording event. In other words, as when Victor finds this, whatever it is they have in their vaults, or probably something more complicated like Blue that someone on tape, and that event gets a master number, which is recorded somewhere with the personnel and the dates and everything else. And then one can build their cataloging based on that master of this recorded event. But that depends on a lot of cooperation. So far, we've seen very little cooperation between industry and anyone else. Ours seems to be a nice venue for cooperation between collectors, professional, and institutions. Amateurs and professional collectors and institutions, but we haven't brought the industry in yet. That's a challenge. They're doing it, or at least they're talking about doing it. If there would be some way to, get in on that, there seems to be your solution, have this master event number. That's a tough challenge.
Well, the master event number can be built right out of the recording date.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, the recording date, as you said, the statement of responsibility. I mean, I think this 100 field is ridiculous. That should have been thrown out years ago, the idea of a main entry. The main entry should be Brunswick, 1931, June 7th, and then something else. It certainly is a, Hoagy Carmichael or a big fire bed.
Jerry. Jerry and Mark both referred to published discographies, but that is an enormous tangle, a lack of accessibility. Remember, there was a time when ARISC had a priority for the bibliography of discographies. It appeared every year in the journal, but with the publication of the three-volume bibliography of discographies and Mike Gray's supplement of the classical, everything has stopped, and there has been no continuation in the ARISC journal, and no apparent demand for this information. The problem is getting from the publication of the discography with the dates into the cataloging, and that's not happening, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, that's an extremely tall order. In my current job, I only have responsibility for Chicago Symphony recordings, and we worked on a discography that's chronological,
that has exact recording dates, and then we link that to all reissues. Well, we're reissued at such an astounding rate, we can barely keep up with that, and that's only one that's only one body of recordings. I mean, it's just really a tall order.
So, therefore, the fact that the data has been published, or in the case of the New York Philharmonic, Steve's, mm-hmm. yours is not published, is it?
We're still working on it.
And there's a Philadelphia that Mike Gray has that's not published. The three major orchestras, Boston has a complete discography, which I don't think is published in its current up-to-date format. This stuff is not available.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was just going to add the one edit to this that everyone seems to forget that we're in the electronic era now. Part of the reason, the results is partly that we're getting such sloppy work done. However, it does have possibilities for a catalog. How many of these databases are now available on CD-ROM or available through the internet? Look at an internet directory and see how much material that we're interested in.
Well, I don't think it's a reality yet. I mean, we're working on it, and we hope to have our discography published on the net within the next couple of years, but it's just not a reality yet.
The point is, if you are cataloging, you want to find out when a particular thing was done or what number was assigned to it. Our Regler Deutsch, is that available? It's available. Not as far as I know, unless it's in the which one, the New York Public one. But how many people have used that in their catalog?
It's on Ireland.
It's on Ireland.
Yeah. But that's it.
You got to subscribe to Ireland.
You got to subscribe to Ireland and all the rest. Mm-hmm. So as I say, if we can get this stuff into an electronic form where it's available to catalogers by punching in and seeing what's done, why reinvent the wheel and have to recatalog the whole darn thing if you've got it already?
Elwood?
An international standard recording number has been proposed. It even made progress through standards-setting agencies, and the industry absolutely vetoed doing it. The reason that it was started, though, was the difference between recordings published in various parts of the world, where they put together different recording events published in England and published in Japan would be a different one, or published in the United States would be a different one, and the international standard recording number was to really come back to the sort of thing that Steve is talking about, identifying not by title or subject matter, but by recording event number. And as I say, the industry, this goes back for nearly 5 years, industry completely said no.
The International Standard Recording Code, there are some European companies that do use it.
Yeah.
And
they put them on the CD.
Yeah.
But it's still so limited in use.
And very strange.
One more question?
Sure.
I just wondered if you're taking into account the rules for archival description that are being developed for non-commercial.
Say that once more, please.
I just wondered if you're taking into account the rules for archival description that are emerging.
Well, up until this was issued, which was about a year ago, we included as much information as we knew about. To wrap up, I'd like to say that I think that this has been a very interesting session, and the comments that people have had have been very, very good. And I would like to say that one of the solutions, it seems to me, is one that we were looking at 20-odd years ago as we started the AAA, and that is cooperation. And the idea of somebody creating the Ur catalog record, the initial catalog record, and then other people building upon that, rather than everybody creating the original cataloging record. And so the work of something like of what Jerry's doing here at Edison. So here's the basic Edison recording information, and other institutions ought to be able to take that and then add in the specific information that they have on their own recordings, that rather than having to create it all from scratch. Because when we all create it from scratch, as we basically do today, even though we have a very, the libraries have a very intricate set of union catalogs, it's a terrifically expensive system. And it's one that then keeps us limited at only providing the very basic information rather than all of that good information that we really want to have. So I want to push for cooperation. Thank you very much. Thank you.